and Patricia Chong and Corrine Ng from the Ontario and BC branches of the Asian Canadian Labour Alliance. The three discuss the history of the alliance, key moments of Asian labor in Canada, and how racism, systemic discrimination, and othering still shows up in Canada today. A little bit about our guests this week. Patricia Chong holds an A in Labor Studies from McMaster University and a Master's in Labor Policies and Globalization from the Global Labor University in Germany. She is a short documentary filmmaker and a member of the Asian Canadian Labor Alliance Ontario chapter. Corrine Ng is an immigrant settler on Turtle Island whose work is anchored in education spanning across diverse ages and sociocultural settings in the ancestral lands of the Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh peoples and elsewhere. The Asian Canadian Labor Alliance is a national organization that represents the voices of Asian Canadian trade union members, Asian Canadian workers, and the Asian community at large. Here are Kia Lucero, Patricia Chong, and Corrine Ng in conversation. Take a listen.
So hello, Patricia and Corrine. Thank you so much for joining me on Rabble Radio today. Just to get started, can I get you both to introduce yourselves?
Thank you. Hi, my name is Patricia Chong. I'm a member of the Asian Canadian Labor Alliance, the Ontario chapter. I have been involved with the labor movement on and off for the past 20 years, specifically working as a union organizer in Ontario, Nunavut, Northwest Territories, and the Yukon, and I work as an education officer doing labor education with a focus on a popular education approach. And I also like to work on short documentary filmmaking, and some of that work has overlapped with some of the topics we'll be discussing today in terms of confronting anti-Asian oppression in Canada.
Nice. Hi, Kia. So thanks very much for this opportunity. So my name is Corrine. My given name is Ngotwing, pronouns she, her. I'm an immigrant settler on these lands. Currently, I'm on the traditional and stolen territories of the Homothquiam, Tsleil-Waututh, and Squamish nations, aka Vancouver. So I am an educator. I've been in K-12 public education system for the last 20 years. Currently, I am in an elected position with the British Columbia Teachers Federation, the Vancouver local, and we represent elementary teachers and adult educators who work for the Vancouver School Board. Education is obviously, you know, my passion. In this particular role, I do a lot of administration, but my passion actually lies in, you know, organizing and, you know, political action. That's where I draw my joy. And anti-oppression, you know, is definitely something that grounds my work. I am originally from Hong Kong, which is also a colonized place that under the British Empire. So I've lived my entire life in the empire.
Thank you for all of the introductions and everything. Let's just start by talking a little bit about Asian Canadian Labor Alliance. Can you just give me a bit of background on ACLA, please? Maybe we could start with you again, Patricia, and then we'll go on to you, Corrine.
So ACLA, or the Asian Canadian Labor Alliance, is almost 25 years old. Essentially, the role of ACLA, and I'm talking from the Ontario chapter, and I'm happy that Corrine's here because she can talk about the BC chapter. Essentially, ACLA started out when we had several Asian activists in Canada go over to the United States, and they saw APALA, and they saw an example of, you know, race-based organizing in the American context. And so ACLA was founded to mirror that within a Canadian context. And also they had the Coalition of Black Trade Unionists also as a model. That is both in the United States and Canada. There's a very strong Canadian contingent as well. And so ACLA was aware of these opportunities for race-based organizing, understanding that even though we're all working class is often filtered through race, gender, sexual orientation, et cetera. And so in order to challenge racial capitalism, there needs to be a worker consciousness that also understands how race is used in terms of dividing the working class. And so ACLA, in terms of its its current form in Ontario. Specifically, I would say largely in Toronto, has been working with other labor unions in terms of education and learning and unlearning and the labor movement, trying to, again, bring a race-based analysis to trade unionisms, the work we do both as activists and as staff sometimes, and also trying to engage in politics where, you know, we have people who self-identify as quote-unquote Asian, you know, running for office, running for their union positions, trying to provide support to racialized staff when they've been mistreated, harassed, discriminated against. So a little bit of a hodgepodge, if you will. And some of the key organizers back then were Winnie Ng, who's a very well-respected activist. We also had Chris Ramsrud, who's heavily involved with the migrant farmers issues. We have Jenny Ong, who's also, you know, was with Unifor for many years. And right now, I would say Anna Liu, who is also an organizer. She has been really holding the fort down in terms of the work that ACLA Ontario has been doing. So it's always great to have the energy and the activism going on, but there is also the other side, which is not as exciting, responding to emails, coordinating meetings. And I do want to give a shout out to Anna Liu because she's, like I said, has been really holding the fort down, I would say, with ACLA Ontario for the last 20 years or so.
Now, Corinne, I understand that the British Columbia chapter of ACLA was established back in 2020. Can you tell me what influenced the start of the BC chapter?
Yeah, so my understanding, so I started being part of ACLA in BC in 2020, and it was actually a relaunch of the BC chapter that had been dormant for 10 plus years. So in 2000, I believe that there were members who went to APALA, as Patricia mentioned, and they were from British Columbia, and they were also like very inspired. And so there was like kind of like this parallel establishment of an Ontario and a BC chapter. But over the years, Ontario kind of kept going and BC kind of went dormant after some time. And then what happened in 2020 was, you know, we were kind of in the middle of a global pandemic, and a few of us were really seeing the rise in anti-Asian racism and felt that, okay, you know, like, what can we do, not just individually, but as a collective? And so I will give a shout out to Nat Lowe, who now based in San Francisco. He was a transplant from California. You know, he was a union organizer working in BC at the time with the Health Sciences Association. And he connected me with Stephanie Fung, who is now in Toronto and is connected with ACLA Ontario. She's since relocated, and Monica Urrutia. So Monica is a longtime labor activist, also outside of labor. She's done a lot of organizing, has years and years of experience, and she's a key element in bringing this group together. So, and then also Eric Sito. And I will also credit Gail Nye, who was one of the original founders of the BC chapter almost 24 years ago. She's based in Victoria, BC. And so she also came together at that moment. And so the few of us got together and started, you know, trying to revive it. And everything was done online because of the lockdown and everything. But we kind of really capitalized on the technology at the time. And there was a genuine desire of many folks who wanted to connect on this issue. And so we relaunched it in November of 2020. And it just happened to be the 20th anniversary of the organization. And then since then, we've been having almost monthly meetings up until today. So it's very exciting. And we've had like new members join as well. So very exciting times.
Definitely. Thank you so much for that, Patricia and Corinne. And I would definitely like to touch on that a little bit more, and the rise of anti-Asian racism in the midst of the pandemic and everything, and how that came up. But first, can we talk a little bit about the history of Asian Canadian labor and their contributions to Canada?
Yes, the Asian Canadian Labor Alliance, ACLA, actually recognized that there was a gap in terms of recognizing the contributions of Asian Canadians to Canadian history and specific labor history. So ACLA, working with an artist, created a series of banners, stand-up banners, i.e. scrolls, to highlight not just examples of Asian Canadian labor history from the past to now, but also examples of cross-racial solidarity, examples of strikes where we have people organizing across racial lines. And when we say Asian, people tend to think of Chinese when we say Asian, but we mean Asian very broadly. So ACLA, the Asian in ACLA is, you know, pan-Asian. We recognize South Asian, East Asian, Southeast Asia. And of course, within the Canadian context, we recognize, again, an intersectional approach, understanding that we will have different experiences, even within the category of quote unquote Asian, class differences, ethnicity differences, the importance of immigration, and all those things. So we do recognize that, and that is somewhat recognized in our ACLA banners. In a nutshell, the idea essentially that quote unquote Asian members, East Asian, South Asian, and in general have systematically been excluded purposely from the labor movement. As we know with, you know, you probably saw the heritage moments where there's, you know, the Chinese workers are on the railway. We often hear those stories. And of course, those stories are very sad and important to remember, this idea that Chinese workers were brought in to create the railway to connect Canada. And while Canadians will often celebrate July 1st as Canada Day, ACLA, among other groups, also call it Shame Day, or a day of shame, because the Chinese Immigration Act or Exclusion Act was passed July 1st, 1923. And that was one of the first race-based acts saying, if you are X race, you are not welcome in this country. And of course, a lesson for all people, not just Chinese people, is this idea of powerful ideas and beliefs about Asian people. What were the institutional policies put in place to actively exclude them? And systemically speaking, their use of labor. And when that labor was no longer needed, they were essentially discarded. So I think the Chinese railway is a big one that people like to talk about. Obviously, Japanese internment camps, the same thing, the same idea of always being othered, no matter how long you live. Lived here, things that we saw arise during COVID, not that they were ever gone, they were always prevalent, but they just came to the forefront. So Canadian niceties and Canadian politeness were revealed to just be masking underlining xenophobia. And the fact that, again, with the Japanese internment camps, we had people who were born and raised in Canada, again, being viewed as other. It doesn't matter how long you've been in Canada, if it's generations or not, you're always going to be considered not Canadian. And we saw those issues again arise in COVID. We also have I'm looking at the scrolls, Komagatu Maru. Again, this was in 1914. Again, another direct challenge about Canada's racist immigration laws, where we had people arrive at the Vancouver Harbor. Maybe Karine can talk a bit more about that. In a nutshell, though, I think it is important for these scrolls, obviously knowing the history, but I think there's some really exciting examples of resistance, which I was not aware of, and some of them are actually much more recent. There was actually one point when all three Chinese newspapers in Toronto were actually organized. So there was the Tsing Tao Daily, that was in 2001. Then we had the World Journal, 2006, they were organized as well. And then in Ming Pao was another Chinese newspaper that was organized in 2011. So there was at one point all the ethnic newspapers were organized at that point. And then lastly, sorry, I don't want to go through all of them. One thing I thought was really interesting that I didn't know, and of course, this is a learning process for us as well, because we're not taught this in school. The idea of the union bug or the union label, which you often see on unionized products or, you know, unionized documents. We like that because it shows us who created the document. But the history of the union bug is actually that it was developed in the 1880s in response to perceived unfair competition from Chinese workers. So the idea of the union bug back then was actually to make sure it was produced by white labor, as opposed to other forms of labor. So in a nutshell, very important to understand the history, not only the examples of systemic oppression, which we still see today under different guises, but also examples of cross-cultural, cross-racial organizing.
Corinne, would you like to add kind of maybe a Western perspective on this too as well?
Yeah, for sure. You know, we're situated here on, you know, the Pacific Rim being kind of a portal to Asia, like historically immigration, those, you know, like Asian workers that, you know, in the Eastern, like so-called Eastern Canada, often comes through where I am right now. And so, you know, that kind of, you know, their history of, you know, their whether they're indentured laborers or, you know, their family members, you know, joining their spouses, usually male, single male who are working here, you know, that comes through this part. So what Patricia mentioned earlier, the Komagata Guru, right? Like we're talking about a ship, that was sitting out in the water and not being allowed to dock, you know, on land, because that ship contained South Asian workers looking for refuge. And, you know, it took a long time. And actually, they were attacked while they were on the ship. And so without repeating what Patricia said, but I just want to supplement, even though we as Asian workers have so-called contributed to Canada, everything is so-called, right? You know, is that we also contribute to the settler colonial project. So it is really important for us to also examine where we came from. Many of these workers came from very oppressed backgrounds and situation. And so having that anti-oppression lens is important. And many of us also come from formerly colonized places, or even until today, you know, are still reeling from the legacy of colonialism. So, you know, I think recognizing our role, you know, as settlers and as immigrants in particular moments in history, the waves of migration, right? Like what my ancestors, what drove my parents, what drove, you know, Patricia's ancestors to come, you know, maybe different, you know, in specifics. But I think what the strength of this organization and the work that we do is to recognize the common ground. There are things that are very different, or contexts, right? For example, in the contemporary context, we're seeing a lot of international students coming, and they're really filling the role of, you know, migrant workers. That is the de facto way, you know, that the Canadian government is trying to fill, you know, like sort of low paid service kind of jobs, construction, like farm workers, like that sort of thing. And so, you know, it's recognizing that, you know, we may have different circumstantial, you know, sort of reasons for being here, but, you know, the common ground here, you know, what do we have in common? And I love what Patricia said earlier about, you know, the racism and the white supremacy that has been there since day one within, you know, the Canadian labor movement. Doesn't matter whether it's, you know, in Ontario or BC, the story is the same. I'll just highlight one particular example, is that the Vancouver Labor Council was actually responsible for inciting the anti-Asian riots in Vancouver in 1907. Just leading up to that riot, that council was actually stoking public discontent and anger against, you know, Japanese and Canadian residents in Vancouver. And that led to the riots. And so, you know, we must not shy away from facing that history. And I say we, that includes us, because we are also part of that legacy, even though our ancestors have been victimized, that we are also part of that legacy now, because we're part of this society. So, you know, it's complex, but it's actually not that complicated. It's complex to understand our history. But, you know, if you look at it from an anti-oppression lens, it's actually not that complicated. It has always been there. And we're still seeing remnants and specters of that, but just through different policies, right? Differential and unequal treatment of immigrants and workers that land in so-called Canada. And the one last thing that I will add is, you know, kind of comparing the past to the present is the geopolitical tensions. I'm definitely noticing that. And also, of course, technology, social media, and the discourse that happens on there. You know, I really notice that it is impacting perceptions, and sort of, you know, like social media can, you know, act as a echo chamber, and, you know, that kind of, you know, like toxic rhetoric being circulated really quickly. And so, like, how racism shows up is very interesting. It's really changing the landscape. But again, the root is the same. like the manifestations may look different, but the root is the same. But there's definitely a latent danger there, just because the power of social media and how the quickness and fastness of how information travels and how it can just influence large swaths of people, you know, with algorithms and things like that. And I'm just finding that with the geopolitical tension, right, between different countries, the tension between China and the US and also with Canada, India, you know, those are just some examples of how, you know, I'm seeing, you know, sometimes we're scapegoated for really things that we're not responsible for as individuals, and the regimes get confounded with the people.
That was the first half of the conversation between Patricia Chong and Corinne Ng from the Ontario and BC branches of the Asian Canadian Labour Alliance and Rabble's own labour reporter, Kia Lucero. Please tune in next week for part two of this discussion. For additional information, resources, and reading and watching materials mentioned in this interview, please review our show notes of this episode in your podcast app or on rabble.ca. Switching gears now, it's time for a segment we like to call In Case You Missed It. And for that, let's turn it over to Rabble editor Nick Seabrook. Take it away, Nick.
This week in national news, students across North America are protesting on university campuses to show solidarity with Palestinians. In Quebec, students at McGill University in Montreal have set up an encampment on campus and have been there since Saturday. Both the university and the Premier of Quebec, François Legault, have asked police to intervene to remove the student protesters. The students, however, say that they are unfazed by these threats of police violence. The students are calling for an end to the violence in Gaza and for their university to divest itself from companies that are supporting the Israeli government in their oppression of Palestinian people. Rabble columnist Judy Rebick analyzed the student protests and explained how they mark a turning point in the pro-Palestinian movement. Rebick compares the protests to the anti-war protests of the 1960s and 70s, which were also driven by students. A difference that Rebick notes is the minimal amount of violence amongst the student protesters, along with a better level of organization. She explains that these protests will be remembered for shifting public opinion towards the Palestinian cause and for being a defining moment in the lives of many future lifelong activists. Rebick writes, quote, "I have no question that this recent youth uprising will be as transformative as the youth uprising of my generation," end quote. In labor news, this weekend marked the National Workers' Day of Mourning on April 28th. To mark the occasion, Rabble labor reporter Kia Lucero took a look at the Westray Law and examined how this landmark legislation has not met. The Westray Law was passed in 2004 and was designed to provide harsher penalties to companies that failed to provide adequate workplace safety precautions for their employees. Since 2004, there have been just a handful of successful prosecutions under the Westray Law, and only one individual faced any jail time. This law is named after the Westray mine disaster, which took place in Nova Scotia in 1992. 26 miners from Plymouth, Nova Scotia lost their lives in an explosion. Concerns over workplace safety at the mine had been raised prior to the disaster by employees and government officials. Unions, including the United Steelworkers, are calling for the law to be reformed so that it can be better enforced. Staying in labor news, this week also marked International Workers' Day, or May Day, on May 1st. This past year was historic for Canadian workers. Unions, like Unifor, were able to secure historic contracts for their workers, particularly in the auto sector. Workers were also able to celebrate several legislative victories too, most notably the introduction of federal ICAB legislation. More work still needs to be done, though, particularly to protect migrant workers, who can be vulnerable to exploitation by their employers. The Migrant Rights Network is currently engaged in a campaign to lobby the federal government to introduce better protections for migrant workers. And finally, Rabble Agricultural columnist Lois Ross is talking about the dangers that free trade can pose to seed diversity. Ross explains how countries like Mexico are now trying to protect their native crops, like corn, from the negative effects of free trade agreements. Under agreements that Mexico has with Canada and the United States, it is required to use and import corn seeds from those countries. The corn that Mexico is required to import is often genetically modified, which usually requires significant use of chemical pesticides to maintain. Mexico is working to pass legislation banning the import of genetically modified corn, which is just one example of a consequence that free trade can have on our food ecosystem. To read the full version of all the stories we talked about today, please visit rabble.ca.
Thanks, Nick. And that's it for Rabble Radio this week. Thanks as always for tuning in. If you like the show, please consider subscribing to Rabble Radio on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And please rate, review, share Rabble Radio with your friends. It takes 2 seconds to support independent media like Rabble. If you have feedback for the show, ideas, stories, opinions you'd like us to cover, we'd love to hear about it. Get in touch with us anytime at editor@rabble.ca. Also, did you know Rabble is in the middle of our spring fundraising campaign? It's thanks to the generous support of our readers, listeners, and donors that Rabble is able to share news for the rest of us. Become a Rabble Rouser today and consider gifting a one-time or monthly donation. Thank you to all the journalists and writers who contributed to this week's content on rabble.ca, and thank you to Carl Nirenberg for supplying the music. Lastly, thank you to you for tuning in to Rabble Radio. I'm Brianne Doyle, and I'll talk to you.
A lot like musical chairs, except not with chairs.
When the music stops, more than 250,000 Canadians, many of them children, don't have a home.
But if we act right now with urgency, we can fix it.
Don't let homelessness assumptions get in the way of homelessness solutions. Go to CanadaCanDoIt.ca.
Help the Canadian Alliance to End Homelessness.
Hi, it's Mike, host of Noise of Carpet on Wednesdays at 1 p.m., reaching out with a very special pronouncement. Thank you for keeping your radio dial locked on CJSF 90.1 FM. Each time you tune in, you're part of something bigger. Independent voices and programming for all, and we are grateful to you for that. Thank you for listening, and do not adjust your set.